our opening materials and turn things over to your session facilitator, James Rice from ICF. James, please get started.
Thanks, Jean, and thank you all for joining us today. As Jean mentioned, I'm Jim Rice, and I'll be your session moderator. Looks like we have a pretty good crowd gathered with us today and logged on. We also have a really great group of speakers who I'll introduce in just a minute or two. But first, I'd like to say a few words about the ORD webinar series. So EPA's Office of Research and Development has designed this series of webinars to explore some of the challenges that we face with these mining sites and mineral processing facilities. For those who aren't familiar, ORD is EPA's scientific research arm, and they help inform agency decisions through their research. The objective of these seminars is to both inform you, the practitioners and stakeholders, about the latest tools and methods available to you, but also to understand your research needs and how ORD can further support your needs. The webinars are designed to be interactive and generate discussion, just like we do at a technical conference if we were all standing together in the hallway. So in light of our interest in getting your feedback, the speakers and I have developed a series of interactive activities throughout the speakers' presentations and up front to try to understand what's going on in the area of mining. To get you warmed up to these online interactions, you can see we posed a couple of questions early on dealing with what challenges you have in minerals and mining processing sites, and also some of the specific technologies that you've used, which we'll be talking about a little bit later today. So it looks like folks have a pretty broad range of experience. A lot of folks have used source controls like CAPS as well as soil amendments, but there's also some innovative technologies, soil amendments, bioreactors, and some ex situ treatments. So these are some of the things that we'll talk about today. But some of the challenges we face out there are really quite broad. These are very large areas. The mines tend to cover great areas with very complex sources between the mine waste and the groundwater. There's a lot of interaction between the different types of waste, groundwater, surface water, soils, sediments. There's a lot of unstable conditions. And of course, because of the size of the sites and the complexity, we have much higher remediation costs commonly at these sites compared to other Superfund sites. So to address the challenges, we really need to find some more effective ways to address these throughout the project lifecycle. That is all the way from site characterization through closure and long-term monitoring. Some of these might include innovative characterization or innovative data management tools, considering emergency responses or applying adaptive management strategies to more effectively design and implement remediation. So this series of talks brings together experts to explore the latest thinking in all of these areas. Your job as participants in the seminar is to listen, ask questions, and give us your feedback. So today's session will focus on the innovative technologies and strategies that are currently being used to manage some of these challenging mine sites and to address some of the challenges that we've seen. Our first presentation is from Kate Garufi with EPA OzReady. Kate's going to talk about the concepts behind adaptive management, which I'm sure you've all heard the term, and Kate will explain what it is and how it's being successfully applied at a couple of different mining sites. So Kate's the design and construction subject matter at EPA headquarters in Washington. She's also the chair of the Adaptive Management Task Force Work Group. Next, we're going to look at EPA's experience in addressing some of the challenges revegetating mine sites, which is a challenge that some of you have identified. Mark Johnson will talk about the process that he uses to assess site conditions and develop successful soil amendment solutions. Dr. Johnson's a research soil scientist at ORD over in Corvallis, Oregon. His primary area of expertise is the use of biochar in remediating mine sites, and he'll talk about that today. Chris Eckley is our finest speaker for the afternoon. He'll talk about some of the challenges and solutions for managing mercury contamination at a variety of different types of mine sites, and some of the solutions that he's seen to reduce methylmercury uptake in biota. So with that, we encourage you to participate actively in the discussions, ask questions using the tools on your laptop, and responding to the various poll questions that we pose throughout the sessions. So now I'd like to turn the presentation over to our first speaker, Kate Garufi. Kate?
All right, thank you. All right, while this is loading for me, I wanted to thank everybody for attending the presentation today. As noted earlier, I'm going to be talking a bit about adaptive management and really focus on some of the efforts we're doing under the Superfund Task Force. So in my 30 minutes of presentation, I'm going to give you a brief overview of adaptive management, really at a high-level conceptual framework, to give you a better understanding or level set on what adaptive management is and some of the potential benefits or actual benefits at Superfund sites and specifically mining sites. I'm going to talk a bit about the pilots and what we are piloting or the tools that we are working through to inform a guidance that will be developed this upcoming fiscal year. And then I'm going to take some of the key elements of that adaptive management plan and talk about two of the six pilots that we are implementing at large complex mining sites. So a little overview here. I'm not going to read these slides, but adaptive management is a term that's used frequently in many different sites, sediment sites, mining sites, complex groundwater sites. And enough credence has been given to it that when Superfund initiated its task force efforts, one of the recommendations was to broaden the use of adaptive management at Superfund sites with a focus on complex sites. So going a little bit into what the common issues are at complex sites is, I think when you're thinking about mining sites specifically, they're so, the larger and more complex they get, the harder it is to really navigate through the conceptual site model and spending resources to gain an understanding, prioritize activities, and make decisions. And a lot of times there's a lack of consensus there, and it's generally based on risk appetite. And I'm not talking about human health and the environment risk, but project management risk. Some stakeholders tend to be more risk adverse, meaning that they tend to be conservative in the types of information they want before making decisions and moving forward. Other entities tend to be on the opposite side of the spectrum and are willing to make decisions with a lot more uncertainty or risks and change things as they go. So the issue is not to mitigate all risks or address all risks at complex site. The issue is, how do you identify it and manage it so that you can keep these sites moving forward? In addition to this whole issue with project risk management and uncertainty management, it's a lot of times when we talk about complex sites, we talk about a lot of different stakeholders. There tends to be a lack of structure documented and an understanding of decision making. With a lot of people sitting at the table, it tends to be a little cloudy or convoluted sometimes as to who is the decision maker, who's being informed, who's being consulted throughout the process at these mining sites that can be, you know, many years, if not decades. In addition, with Superfund, and I find this generally when I talk to folks about the Superfund process, is it tends to be explained to people in terms of a linear process. You start with investigation, you analyze alternatives, you make a decision, you design, you implement, you operate, you're done. With large, complicated sites that have a lot of uncertainty, this linear project mentality really doesn't fit. So how do we break the mold of this linear project mentality and, you know, make it more of a cyclical, adaptive decision-making process? So EPA's working definition of adaptive management here is, what adaptive management is it's innovative in how you approach your site or your project management techniques. It's centered on rigorous site planning and a firm understanding of site conditions and uncertainties. It's rooted in sound use of science and understanding and allows us to operate nimbly and flexibly within the CERCLA fabric or framework. So really, what adaptive management is you don't spend a lot of time learning before you make a decision, get out in the field and start implementing. You take action where you have enough certainty to make a decision, and you implement that action and use that action to demonstrate success and also to learn to take future actions, scope future actions, and continue the moving the site forward. So instead of learning by investigating, we're learning by investigating and learning by doing. So what adaptive management is it's not trial and error. It's not a get out of circle jail free card. It's not a silver bullet where you take a complicated site, you apply adaptive management, all of a sudden it's easy. It's not a one site fits all, size fits all. And again, it's not a makeup as we go. So makeup as we go is sort of the way that adaptive management at a number of projects and Superfund thus far is how it's been done. And I like to say that it's been largely more reactive than proactive. So where we've really been lacking is in the documentation and the upfront planning and the process controls portion of it. And we've sort of been trying to do it by a fly by the seat of our pants type of approach. So this table here sort of shows you what formal adaptive management, which is what we're moving towards, looks like versus informal adaptive management, which is what we've been seeing historically at a lot of Superfund sites where the term has been used. And again, highlighting or sort of forecasting as to what we're doing with the pilots is it lacks structured documentation. So the elements of adaptive management is a term that's been used since the 1970s, really focusing on natural resources, Department of Interior type work. These elements of adaptive management were not made up by EPA. These are the six elements that really are the cornerstones of adaptive management and site management plans. Again, I think what's super important when you're looking at this is a lot of these things, when you read them, shouldn't seem weird at a Superfund site. We have objectives in CERCLA. A lot of times they're record of decision remedial action objectives. At mining sites, I'm sure you guys can list on one or two hands the number of models that you use in characterization, design, and implementation. There's always a ton of work to be done, prioritizing activities that need to be done, monitoring and assessment of activities, and then incorporating learning into future decisions. And last, of course, stakeholders. So when you look at the elements of adaptive management, I think you can really crosswalk CERCLA and see that a lot of these things, CERCLA affords us the opportunity to do. Again, it's just a structure of doing them and being transparent. So the potential advantages of adaptive management at Superfund sites is streamlining decision-making, facilitating site progress and cost control. So when I talk about streamlining decision making, what that's saying is if we are proactive and spend more time in planning and document it, it's going to streamline the day-to-day decision making because all of your stakeholders are going to be on the same page as you get into project execution. By bringing all the stakeholders there, it strives and builds towards stakeholder consensus, captures priorities of everybody at the table. And last but not least, I've been hammering home, it's a transparent documentation of management and resource decisions. In addition, when you take a mining site where a challenge at a mining site is, getting to final record of decision, a lot of times that's, a long time away from when you begin your investigation activities, especially when it's large and complex. So what it can do is by being organized and structured in your planning process, it can allow you to look for CERCLA opportunities like early actions, whether it's removal or remedial, interim actions that can do earlier human health and ecological risk reduction, can do early source control activities, which are critical to site completion and success. And, if you have parts of a mining site that could be put into beneficial reuse, that's something that can be explored up front. So you're not trying to execute these flexibilities while you're midstream in doing work. You're sort of planning to use them from the beginning. And last, with adaptive management, we talk about cost control. So one of the misnomers, I think, with adaptive management is people generally think, if I use adaptive management, I'm going to clean up my site and it's going to be less costly than if I didn't. And that's not necessarily the case. What it does is, it allows you to prioritize limited resources on collecting the key information you need to move the site forward. It allows you to explore the use of innovative technologies, whether it's treatability studies, site investigation, or design and construction, and allows you to update remedial approaches as needed based on new information. So the idea is you're getting the best bang for your buck every time you're spending money because you're always trying to move the gauge forward on site progress. So what we decided to do in the task force for adaptive management is a lot of times when you talk to people about adaptive management and you say, you know, one of the keys to adaptive management is writing a plan. The first thing people generally tend to think, especially when you're in a regulatory program, is, oh, no, another plan or another document that I have to produce. So it's a difficult and hard sell because adaptive management is a project management approach that's pretty conceptual, and most people generally think they're using it already. So what we decided to do in the pilot program is, in order to formalize adaptive management and show the benefit of this proactive planning versus reactive execution of adaptive management, before we wrote the guidance document, we were going to write it informed by actually executing adaptive management in a formal structure at a number of Superfund sites that were pilot candidates. So, as I mentioned before, with adaptive management, we're doing 6 pilots. 3 of them are at mining sites. 3 of them are at complicated groundwater sites. And what we are doing in these pilots that are underway is we're developing an adaptive management site or project management plan. And it's a general structure that we've been developing with a template, and we're working with the region headquarters stakeholders, whether they're states, tribes, other federal agencies, in developing this plan. And for the rest of my presentation, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the benefits of the plan, what's in the plan, and 2 of the 3 mining pilots that are underway, and what we're doing at them and how it highlights the benefit of these components. So just so you guys can read this, the role of the adaptive management plan, again, is that formal documentation up front. It increases process transparency. It's a process for prioritizing actions and a method for course adjustments based on evolving site understanding. So what it is it's a plan that is not written once and finalized, but it is the plan under which the project is executed and has a cadence for revisiting the key components of it. The key components of it being the site principles for your project and the adaptive management decision-making process. So what I'm going to do for the rest of the presentation is first I'm going to talk about site principles, then I'm going to talk about one of the pilots, then I'll move over to the adaptive management decision-making, and then talk about a second pilot. So what are the site principles? This is probably a new term for people that are familiar with Superfund or even project management in general. So what the site principles are and how we use them in adaptive management is they are the goals for the project, the prioritization of the goals for the project, key objectives or adaptive management decision points to make progress towards the goals, and then a preliminary site or project level strategy and schedule. So before we get into going out in the field and starting to execute, what the site principals do and what they do in the adaptive management plan is they sit down, they take a time out, they get all the stakeholders at the table, they hash out their goals, they hash out their priorities, they talk about key decisions, they do a risk or uncertainty analysis. And what that does at the end of the day is it results in a preliminary site or project level strategy and schedule. And what that does is on day one, after that is done, everybody is moving forward with the same understanding of where they're heading. So what this is I call it the site compass. So this gives the framework under which all decisions should be made with the goal of moving further along in that strategy, getting to those key objectives or decision points, and then reaching those goals. In addition, as we can all think, if anybody has a large complicated mining site on the phone, on day one after you list the site on the national priorities list in Superfund, you're going to put a site strategy down on paper, which in 5 to 10 years may look a bit different than what you thought 10 years ago. And that's fine. What adaptive management does is it recognizes the high probability of change. It puts the initial plan on paper and puts a cadence in for being able to update that site strategy. So the goals, the objectives, the priorities, and the site level strategy are updated on a frequency to be determined by the site or project. So let's talk a bit about development of site principles at a large complex mining site. So one of the pilots that we're doing for adaptive management is at the Bonita Peak Mining District, which in Superfund terms is a pretty new site. It's about 5 years old, 4 or 5 years old on the national priorities list. So when you think about that linear Superfund process, we're early in the remedial investigation phase at this project. So there's a lot of work to be done and a lot of things that need to be addressed. So this site being early in the remedial process is perfect for adaptive management and especially setting the initial site principles at a larger complex mining site. So the Bonita Peak site, I'd like to talk a little bit about the challenges of why it's complex. For folks that know it, you're probably pretty aware of this, but I'll just go over these quickly. So in the beginning, you all said one of the big issues at mining sites is the size of them. Well, Bonita Peak is a great example of a very large, complex mining site, and by mining site, we mean a mining district listed on the MPL. So there's over 300 historic mines in the Bonita Peak Mining District. Silverton, where most of these mines are located, or I'll say the greater Silverton area, is at 10,000 to 13,000 feet above sea level. So we're dealing with a lot of conditions that, you know, shorten things like construction seasons, make things a lot more challenging and complex from a remote and access point of view. And as I said, there's over 300 historic mines in the Bonita Peak Mining District, but only 48 of these source areas were listed on the national priorities list. So already you have this complicated fabric that you're applying CERCLA in because you have a legacy mining area with far more mining sources than those that are listed on the MPL. So automatically when you think about that, you're like, well, what are your final goals for these projects? And, you know, what are the water quality numbers we're looking for? So what we're dealing with, again, is it's not only one drainage. It's a giant watershed with 48 source areas across three drainages covering over 100 square miles. So big, large, complicated site. Here's a picture of the Bonita Peak Mining District. Durango, which is the larger city, is to the south at the bottom, and Silverton is about bottom right of the picture. So these mines are within, you know, close proximity to the town of Silverton, but a lot of them are really remote. Moving on. Oh, okay, so everybody here is familiar with mining sites, so, you know, every source area at a mining district is a little bit different. So, you know, not only is the site complex because we're dealing with 48 mining source areas within a water district, but every source area in itself has its own general complexity. A lot of times we only list one source area on the MPL. So we're looking at, you know, a complexity of having these 48 different source areas with, you know, seeps, mine-influenced water drainage, waste rock, you know, different exposure pathways, different locations, et cetera. In addition, since there's over 300 historic mining areas in the Silverton area, pretty much if you had a 3D image of the, you know, Red Mountain 1, 2, and 3 in that area and Bonita Peak Mountain, it would look like Swiss cheese. So one of the other challenges here is there's a lot of mines in different mountains and a lot of underground mining working complexities. So it's really difficult, and not only technically, but also from a financial perspective, in getting a good handle on sort of what you're working with from a conceptual site model and a, you know, mine influence water fate and transport perspective when you're looking at these underground mining working. So this is just actually an example of the mapping of the underground mining working complexities in the Bonita Peak Mountain, of which Gold King is one of the historic mining areas in that mountain. In addition, most people know Bonita Peak because Gold King release is one of the 48 source areas. So this site is complicated not only by those logistical complications and the source area complications, but also in the fact that we had the Gold King mine release in 2015. So this site has essentially been managed in a reactionary way since the beginning of it. We had to deal with the Gold King mine release, putting in a very quick interim water treatment plant system in that, you know, has been in for 5 years. It wasn't supposed to be there that long, so we have performance challenges with that. And then also, when the release happened, there are a lot of populations downriver, down the Animas River, from Silverton, Durango, and tribal interests and other states that we have defensive litigation challenges with in that fabric. So this just adds another layer of complexity. And then finally, for anyone that works on mining sites, anytime you have a large mining watershed that you're dealing with, there's a lot of players at the table. So there's state and government interests, federal partner interests, Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, EPA, tribal nation interests, and local population interests. As you can imagine, Silverton, you know, a lot of their interests are in recreation. You know, the resources that are impacted by these mining features is really, you know, the key to a lot of their success and a big financial interest for them. So there's a lot of different interests and a lot of different priorities coming from each of these areas. So with this site being pretty early in the process, we're not that far along in CERCLA. So one of the things that we're doing right now is we're working on a very collaborative, stakeholder-involved development of the site principles. So I'm going to talk briefly about that with you all. So as we talked about before, there's goals, there's objectives, and there's a site strategy. So one of the nice things when we came into the pilot for Bonita Peak is they recognized that they were having a lot of challenges within the stakeholder community as getting an understanding of sort of what were the overarching goals for the work that they were going to be doing in the mining district, and then what were the priority areas or reaches that they were going to be focusing on first. So in early 2019, EPA established goals that they published, and if anyone's interested, you can find them on the internet, and priority reaches. I'll go into them in the next couple of slides. But what they didn't have is, within the framework of those goals and priority reaches, what was the strategy? Like, how were they going to implement CERCLA under that umbrella in order to reach those goals and priority reaches, and what was the timeframes we were looking at? So where we're at now and what we're doing with the Bonita Peak Mining District team as part of the adaptive management plan is we're developing a site strategy. So here are the goals that were developed. These are high-level goals. There's a lot more words. If you're interested, you can read them. But for EPA, these were really the three goals. Of course, CERCLA's goals to minimize human health and ecological risks, but they were looking at goals of water quality improvement, stabilizing source areas, and the third one is to prevent an uncontrolled releases, or as I like to say, a Gold King 2.0. So in order to achieve those goals, they needed to look at this project and say, you know, let's look at the tools that they have. The loading tool was the big model that they were using. What are our priority reaches where we want to focus our resources, make decisions, and take remediation activities on in order to see water quality improvement? So the first reach that you see at the very bottom is the canyon reach. And that is a priority reach. You're going to say, why is that a priority reach? There's no mines there. That's a priority reach because the Animas downriver at Durango is a source of water, drinking water for the town. So meeting water quality numbers in Durango is very important for the stakeholders down there. So a lot of the work that needed to be done up in the watershed needed to reduce loading into the Animas River so that the water quality numbers could be met. So reach one is Canyon Reach. Reach two on the right is the Upper Animas at Howardsville. So a reach where a lot of the big zinc loaders are in the watershed. Reach three, South Fork Mineral of Mineral Creek, and reach four, Upper Mineral Creek. These are large areas of recreation. So these are priority reaches as well because not only do they have loaders, but they're very high interest for recreation, not only for fishing, but camping and other types of things. So again, Canyon Reach. The objective there is to take activities to meet table value standards at a point below the Elk Creek. Reach number two, which is the Animas. There are already trout there, so there is a population and people are fishing there. So a lot of things, sort of what we like to say here is the objective at the Upper Animas right now is to make it troutier. So improve the numbers or spatial extent of the existing brook trout fisheries. This is complicated a little bit by a PRP-led remedial investigation at Mayflower. Most of the rest of the work's being done by EPA. So again, as I mentioned before, there are some uncertainties and challenges there. And then South Fork of Mineral Creek, again, this is a trout corridor. So there are trout. So taking activities to improve the number and diversity of the existing fishery is really important here. So again, making it fishier or troutier is a big goal for them from an eco perspective. Also, again, to control human health exposures for those that are camping. And then last, Upper Mineral Creek, there have historically not been much in terms of fishing there, but there have been recently some fish population that has been found. So there's a lot of investigation that needs to be done in this area to figure out, is this a potential fishery? If it is, what can we do, et cetera? And then finally, although it's not a priority reach, a lot of the big source areas in the watershed district is Cement Creek. That's where Gold King is and where I showed you that underground mine workings picture. So although there's no objective there, it's called Cement Creek, you would think nothing's probably lived there for quite some time. In order to meet the water quality or the table value standards in Canyon Reach, something has got to be done here. So although it's not a priority reach and we don't have quote-unquote goals for Cement Creek, something needs to be done there to reduce the loading to really meet all of the other high-level goals. So for the site strategy, what we are doing is we're focusing on a high-level implementation plan for the next year. And what we're doing is EPA is bringing in all the stakeholders, the state, the other federal agencies, the community groups in Silverton and Durango. And what we're doing is we've developed sort of some site strategy options. How are we going to deal with the site? Are we going to go worst first, source area by source area? Are we going to go for records of decision on a reach-by-reach perspective? So we've thrown all these options out on the table, and we've looked at pros and cons. And what we're doing is, instead of making a decision and informing stakeholders afterwards, we're presenting all the options pre-decisional, and we're asking them for their input on it. We're going to take their input into account and make a recommendation to management for decision-making. So the goals, priorities, and the final site strategy will be put into the adaptive management site management plan and in a cadence to be determined in the plan, they will be updated and revisited. So once you have an adaptive management site strategy, what do you do, right, or site principles? You then need an adaptive decision-making framework. So a structured and iterative way to prioritize activities based on the site principles. So what adaptive decision making does that's a little bit different and documented in the site management plan than they're used to is every action needs to align with furthering your site strategy. Not only that, every action has to say, I am taking this action and I believe it will show me X, Y, and Z. So having a hypothesis for the action and then a robust monitoring and assessment plan to say, okay, is my hypothesis correct? Is it better or is it worse? And based on that learning and that outcome, it should inform what you're going to do next. So it's, again, sort of this thing to the right, plan, do, act, check. So the second pilot that I want to talk about briefly is the Bunker Hill Lower Basin. And what we're going to be talking about here is sort of the adaptive decision-making approach for the Lower Basin. The cool thing about Bunker Hill, I think, from adaptive management perspective, is they've been really implementing one of the more formal adaptive management processes to date. The Bunker Hill site has two areas that they generally focus on, the upper basin, where a lot of design and remedial action work is ongoing, so where a lot of the mining source areas are, and the lower basin, which is more the river and wetlands. So less source areas from a mining perspective, but more where mine waste has come to be located. So the source tends to be more of the in-river sediment than actual mine-influenced water coming out of adits, waste rock, et cetera. So why adaptive management? This one's a little bit different than Bonita Peak because Bonita Peak is early in the RFS process. Bunker Hill is different because they have a record of decision written for the entire lower basin. And what is nice about that record of decision is it has broad and vague remedial action objectives. It is for a large area with minimal data. It has significant uncertainties and multiple potential activities that need to be done. So although the record of decision at the site was written in the early 2000s, I believe it was 2002 off the top of my head, a lot of design and remedial action work hasn't been done. So how adaptive management is being applied here is for a 30 to 50 year record of decision, how are we going to prioritize what activities we're doing where, and then how are we going to learn from them to inform what to do next. Secondly, at all mining sites, funding is always a constraint or a consideration. So how are we going to take limited funding and prioritize it to get the best information through the design and remedial action process for this 30 to 50 year RDRA implementation? So this is just shows you guys just all of the stakeholders at this project. I'm not going to go into them. But some of the key elements supporting planning at the lower basin, you know, one of the six elements of adaptive management is the models to be managed. So one of the things that they have here is they have a lot of models. So they have the enhanced conceptual site model. They have modeling tools. They have the basin environmental monitoring plan. In addition, they have a pretty good process for stakeholder engagement, and they already have the site principles for this record of decision written down in the Lower Basin 2018 strategic plan. So unlike Bunker or Bonita Peak where we're developing those, Bunker Hill already has them. So the question is, how are we going to execute? You see the multi-objective decision analysis tool there. I'm going to talk about that in the next slide. So before we get into it, this Lower Basin record of decision pretty much has for that 30 to 50 year remedial time frame, we're looking at activities to control human health issues. They're generally called the rec sites. So beaches, camping areas where sediment or mine waste has come to be located, wetlands, and then source control or in-river work. So with limited resources and a lot of stuff to do, what do you do when and why? So one of the things that the Bunker Hill team has developed that we're using as part of the adaptive management framework is with, you know, a ton of projects over a very large area, how do we figure out what design and remedial action projects we're going to take on now versus in 10 years versus in 15 years or 20 years? So enter the multi-objective decision analysis prioritization and project selection approach. So what multi-objective decision analysis or MODA is it's a transparent, sound approach for evaluating alternatives when multiple objectives exist. It has criteria for which different projects are rated. So let's take human health or rec sites. You have 50 rec sites at the Bunker Hill Lower Basin. How do you figure out what sites you're going to do first? EPA sits down, looks at the 50 sites, figures out what the top tier of projects are that need to be done, and they go into this multi-objective decision analysis tool. The sediment group for the in-river work does the same piece. The wetlands group does the same piece. Then with the multi-objective decision analysis, when they're evaluating or ranking each potential project against the same evaluation factors, EPA is not the only one doing that ranking. They're bringing in their stakeholders, so states, tribes, basin commission. So there's a lot of people that are doing this, this transparent and sound evaluation and ranking process. The multi-objective decision analysis process fits out everybody's ranking for each criteria or evaluation factor and then figures out which projects float to the top. That process is then fed to the project team, and then management is given what the results are, and then they make a decision on what projects are going to be prioritized. Again, when you're talking design and construction, these projects are going anywhere from a year to 5 years. So you can only accomplish so many projects on a limited budget. So once these projects are selected, one of the things that they had as a lesson learned from the upper basin that they brought to the lower basin is they didn't have a really good way of capturing lessons learned from past projects and having a process of incorporating them into future projects. So if I had just finished a wetlands project, how am I going to gather the lessons learned from that project execution, both in design, contracting, and remedial action, and feed it into the next project to make it more efficient? So what we're doing at this project is in that adaptive management decision making, we're setting up a template for a project execution plan. So every time they select a project after the MODA is done, a project execution plan is done. It's a high-level work plan for the project. But it really focuses not only on, you know, it's almost like a mini adaptive management plan for each project, but it looks at goals and objectives for the project, schedules, milestones, monitoring requirements, and then lessons learned from past projects. That's a typo. So here's just a picture. So once the project execution plan is done, we design, we construct, we implement, And then more importantly, we check. So we monitor, we evaluate, and we figure out what lessons we need to pull out from the monitoring assessment. You know, what parameters were we successful in achieving? What parameters were problematic? And how can we go back in the design process or the construction process and make it better? So what the project execution plan does is it has a formal output, or I like to call a hot wash, for each of these projects so that as we're doing annual review of the project, we can pull those lessons learned out. We can figure out whether that impacts how we're going to prioritize different work, maybe what the criteria are for the multi-objective decision analysis, and then how we want to scope the next project. So again, all that information goes into updating models, updating basin-wide monitoring plans, and updating the MODA tool itself. So here's just some pictures for the monitoring and measuring for effectiveness. And that is what we're doing with Bunker Hill. So for Bonita Peak and Bunker Hill, for Bonita Peak, we plan to have the site strategy. We're in the middle of doing the stakeholder outreach and options assessment and evaluation with them now. So I would say in early calendar year 2020, the site strategy or the site principles should be formalized, the adaptive management to follow in the early spring. In Bunker Hill, we are pretty far along on writing the adaptive management project management plan. I anticipate it to be finalized over this winter. In addition, I just want to point out that I am developing a website for a SharePoint site where a lot of these tools and a lot of these documents will be shared once they're completed. So I encourage you to keep an eye out for that and the pending guidance. So with that, I will take any questions.
All right, Kate. Thank you very much. So it looks like we're just about out of time. I want to remind the audience that you can enter questions in your Q&A box here over on the right of your screen. Feel free to enter questions there, and we will try to take them at the end of the session. It looks like we'll have a little bit of time at the end of the session, but I do want to try to stay on time and get to our next speaker, Mark Johnson. So please do enter your questions, and with that, I will turn the presentation over to Mark Johnson, who will talk about some innovative technologies that use soil amendments and how they've been applied at mine sites. Mark?
Great. Yeah, hopefully you all can hear me.
Sounds good, Mark.
Thanks. Well, welcome, everybody, and thank you for dialing in. I've given a couple of these presentations before with focuses in various areas, but today I want to really talk about the whole area of soil amendments and using them at mine sites and being fairly strategic about that, because I think that we can derive a great deal of benefit and remedial quality from using them appropriately. I have a lot of people I work with, and many of you I've talked to. And so I just want to, my co-authors in this presentation are listed here. So let me get to the right. So I don't know what your mine site looks like, and this is a site that I'm familiar with out in Oregon. It's called the Almeda Mine. It's an abandoned gold mine. You can see what we're faced with is this mining residuals or spoils or materials that is unvegetated. And in this particular case, a fairly steep slope. And the new image shows that it's a slope that directly erodes into the Rogue River, which is a wild and scenic river. And so one of the goals for using soil amendments in the way I'm looking at it is to end up with native vegetation there stabilizing slopes like this in conjunction with, various other things that have been done to remediate the site, and you end up with a site that's stable and not material not being lost from the site either through erosion or leaching. Here's another mine that I work at. It's called the Formosa Mine, again in Oregon. Again, you can see fairly deep piles of material that's left over. This is a fairly high elevation, well, not as high as Bonita Peak, but it's about 4,000 feet. It's a ridge top and has a very droughty summer. And so revegetating a site like this is complicated, but there are some things that we can do. The other thing about this site is just the coarseness of the material that's left behind, which is important. I'm sure many of you deal with this type of material. The third site, and I'm actually in Jasper County today. We were looking at some sites this morning. This is part of the Tri-State Mining District, which really did a lot of mining and lead smelting. And so a lot of these piles, they call them chat piles, are just piled everywhere. And they're contaminated with lead and zinc and cadmium. And the concern is once you do your removal, and the main target objective is removing lead, and it's done by coming in and taking off the spoil material that was distributed all over the landscape, you're left with the subsoil that looks like this. And it's difficult to revegetate. There's a number of issues with it. For example, the years that chat material was there, zinc and cadmium leached into the subsoil, and zinc is really toxic to plants, and so it's in high enough concentration that very few plants will grow. And so you need to take some steps that I think we can be achieved using soil amendments. So kind of to a sort of formal statement of where we're going with this, you know, I think we all can agree that contaminated soils and sediments require some sort of intervention and remediation. That's what a lot of us are focused on, what we're doing. The other thing is that, you know, we know there's a large number of Superfund sites, and there's also a large number of abandoned mines. And these can pose some pervasive risk to human health and environment. And so that's part of our job, is to reduce that risk and help clean up these areas. If you think outside of the U.S., globally, these are even a larger problem. I would add to that, because I am a research soil scientist, that there's a lot of degraded soils, not only in the U.S., but around the world, that really can limit, at some point, food security. And so if some of the things that we deal with in remediating contaminated sites would also apply then to degraded soils. And sometimes you'll have degraded soils in association with your mine sites just because of traffic and the way things have been moved around, what have you, that you'll have to address it. They may not be heavily contaminated, but revegetating would be a good move. So this, I want to just kind of focus the idea is that if we use soil amendments strategically at these mining impacted sites, we can address some of these very specific problems. And I believe that soil amendments can reduce the contaminant exposure by eliminating exposure pathways. We're all familiar with that, with that concept. You can also restore soil quality and the health of degraded soils. This is what becomes important. How do you get success in vegetation that you want to have providing this vegetative cover if you don't create a soil condition that's favorable for plant growth? It also can provide some level of insight to remediation, leading to revegetation, revitalization, and reuse, which I think are all of our objectives here. And finally, I like to say that doing this properly can lead to sustainable site recovery. I don't have a specific definition for this that I probably should have one, but the idea there is that once plants get established and they're allocating carbon below ground, this carbon then is added to the soil. We know that it can complex metals, but it can also increase the quality and stabilization of the soil. So, and then further, you'll have multiple generations of plants through succession that leads to a long-term plant cover. That's what I mean by that. So what are the things that cause limitations at these sites? And we're probably familiar with this, but once we start identifying those and quantifying those, we can then come up with what I call a soil amendment prescription to remedy some of the limitations. So we know that there's chemical limitations. Quite often it's metal toxicity or it's low pH, which is related to metal toxicity, or low organic matter or low nutrients. Secondly, there's an area of physical limitations. Many of these sites can be compacted, and as you see in some of the photographs I showed, they can have a lot of coarse fragments, which are difficult to deal with, and you can ask yourself, how can plants even get started in something looks like that? They have poor infiltration of water or water-holding properties. Sometimes spoil material is very deep. Sometimes it's very shallow. Sometimes there's intermittent water tables, and sometimes slope is an issue. These are all physical problems. And finally, there's the whole biological issue. Sometimes these sites are effectively dead, kind of quote-unquote, with low biological activity. You know, in live soils, there's a whole community of microbes and organisms that are necessary for nutrient cycling and plant growth. And if you do have organisms, sometimes they're really low diversity, or they're the wrong kind of organisms. And a lot of sites that are so acidic, there's only acidophiles. And so that has to be altered or changed. So knowing what your limitations are is one of the first things that we need to consider. Just so you know, and you're probably familiar with what soil amendments are, and as Jim said in the introduction, I focused a lot on biochar, which I really think is a very useful amendment. What's nice about it, it's made from waste biomass, and you can tune its properties in the way that you make it. So it can do very specific things if done properly, again. But these amendments also include things like biosolids, manures, lime from sugar beet processing, wood ash. You can just kind of go down the list, and these are all things that either you've heard of, you may be using, and you can even get down to just traditional lime and nutrients from ag fertilizers. Sometimes can be used to rectify problems. So this is just kind of a list of soil amendments, and I really kind of want to point you to this document, and it's either attached to my presentation, but you can also get the CLUIN website. It's really a useful document. It was appeared in 2007. It still contains useful information about different kinds of amendments, where they can be and should be or should not be used. So I'll send you that direction for some in-print information. Again, back to setting some goals for using soil amendments on mining or metal contaminated sites. Again, we want to immobilize these contaminants through absorption, precipitation, or complexation. And the whole idea is to move mobile phases to immobile phases, taken from a solution phase to a solid phase, which reduces their availability and transport. So you're reducing the hazard, reducing the exposure, and you're taking steps then to restore soil function and the ecosystem services they provide. And finally, again, the goal, in my opinion, is to have a sustainable vegetative cover. And I like to push the native plants, mainly because they're adapted for the climate conditions of your site. Now, it's not, you know, it's maybe not necessarily easy to do this, but with some strategic work and working with botanists, this can be achieved. Again, these vegetative covers, they reduce erosion and leaching, and they add organic matter, again, which adds to the whole sustainable remediation solution. So this image on the left is a view from space of what the Formosa mine looks like. And when I think about setting a goal of having a place revegetated, I think about this is what it looked like, and this is what we want it to look like. And I've added to the bottom right-hand corner, this is a Photoshopped image. I had a colleague who was convinced that we did amazing work because of this image. And but the point is, this is where we'd like to go. We'd like it to look like the surrounding proximal vegetation. And I think you can get there with strategic intervention to promote, again, soil revitalization using soil amendments. And so we've come up, and we've been working on this for a few years, is to a framework. And there's six steps in the framework, and I'll kind of go through them fairly quickly, and I'll kind of work you through how we've done these at one location, and then show you the outcome of this. So initially, we want to define the problem. And you guys do this in your site investigation or your remedial investigation. You characterize the site. I would add then that you need to identify a reference site. And what this does is it's a proximal place that's not contaminated, that's close by, that you can sample and characterize, and will give you information about setting targets and reasonable targets. I was working with a colleague who's got an agricultural background, and he felt like we should always remediate to pH 7. And I said, you know, look, we're not trying to grow corn at Formosa. We're trying to grow trees, and they don't need pH 7. So, you know, again, having a realistic reference site helps you establish what would be a good goal. The second step is defining the remedy. So you take the information you have collected in step one, and start putting the pieces together. It's a bit of a puzzle, and it's part of the planning, and you have to do some laboratory, greenhouse, some other studies to test the viability of this amendment, but it'll make sense as we work through it, where the deficits are and what you need to do. The third step is in this testing step. So once I have an amendment prescription, I want to go and test it. I want to understand if I'm going to apply Lyme, how much Lyme do I apply? How much residual acidity do I need to take into account? Is this going to be sufficient organic matter? What about microbes and soil organisms? So we end up then testing the prescription that we come up with, and sometimes it's iterative. You don't always get it right the first time. In fact, you never get it right the first time. But you learn from the first study, you do a second one, and then you're ready, I think, at that point, to go and field test the remedy. And so that would be the fourth step. You take the information you've learned, and you go to the field with it. And to me, this is demonstrating the efficacy of this treatment at the field site. See, there's some things that you can't replicate in the laboratory. For example, summer drought conditions. You know, in the greenhouse, it's easy to water and what have you, but in the field, you know, you're going to have drought, you're going to have wind, you're going to have cold weather, hot weather. These are all things that you want your prescription, your remedy, to work under field conditions, so you need to field test it. The fifth step is once you're successful here and you have a prescription that works, then it's site remediation. The whole idea is scaling up to the field, and then you're adding amendments, you're revegetating the site, but you're not done. And that's the sixth step, and Kate talked about this, the whole idea of monitoring and verifying the long-term solution. And eventually the goal is the site deletion, meaning that the remedial goals have been achieved, and it's no longer a concern or threat to human health or environment. So I'm going to reiterate a few things that I've already said, but establishing remediation targets. So once you know what the issues are at your site, you need to figure out the extent of the adjustments you need to make, and this helps you develop your remediation prescription. So you take the properties of your site, compare it to that of a proximal, and I put unquote, undisturbed, or I'll call it a target site. You know, how different are they? What needs to be adjusted? How much does it need to be adjusted? And then you use that information to develop this remediation amendments plan. And then you prioritize your activities. So at the Formosa mine, and this is another aerial image, the yellow ellipse shows where we're going to conduct our field trials. The red circle is our undisturbed location or target soil. And this next slide shows a picture of the spoil soil. So it's that coarse fragment, virtually nothing growing. This has been exposed for 20, 30 years, and nothing has come in to grow there. So something needs to be done. The soil on the right is the native soil. You'll see it's got a deep, rich O horizon, and it's got regular soil horizons, and they all have organic matter. But you analyze both of these, and you create a table of data, and we'll get to that in a second. So, again, the target soils has the properties that are achievable probably in the setting. And you may have trouble finding these. If you say you're in an urban setting, where do you find an undisturbed soil in a big city? That's a bit of a challenge. Sometimes the differences are so great that you may be difficult to actually get realistic expectations. And then you, again, figure out what parameters are important. Setting your goals and then prioritizing those. So this data table shows, and Gene, I don't know how to get the arrow up here again. Can you put the arrow up? There, thanks. So if you look over in we have eight parameters that we looked at. There's the parameters. There's their units. Here's their range. Just know that the toxic metals are in parts per million, but inverse. So a small number means there's a lot of it. But so we have the target soil, for Formosa, and here's the actual condition. So you see the soil pH is 2.6. That's a problem. But the native soil is only 5.5. And then you can go down, and you know that if you raise the pH, you'll probably drive down the toxic level of toxic metals. You'll increase the base saturation. You'll need to add some organic matter and nitrogen. They're off by an order of magnitude. They're too low. Density is high. Infiltration rate is incredibly low. And then the microbes are assessed by PFLA are also low. So one way to represent this is using a radar plot. So if you look at the it's like a spider web. If you look at the legs on the web, are those eight parameters I mentioned to you, and then has their value. The green area shows what the target soil is. The orange golden area shows what the existing conditions are. So you can see there's quite a large difference between these two. So, but it tells you, okay, this is where I want to be. This is where I am. Now, what do I need to do to get to that? And that's where you come in developing your prescription. So we know by looking at this, we have low soil pH, and we know that that's going to lead to high metals. If anything, not only this is a copper zinc mine, but also you'll have aluminum that becomes available, and that's very toxic to plants. It's got low organic matter. It's got low nutrients. It's lacking in soil biology and has really poor water infiltration and holding properties. But that tells us then what we need to do. We need to be adding some lime to adjust the pH, we need to add some organic matter, and we need to add some nutrients. And I could have said there that, if we want to address some of these water issues, organic matter will help with some of that, but also biochar will help with that. So here's what we included in our prescription. Lime for the neutralization of acidity, biosolids, and we have a source of Class A biosolids within 15 miles of this site, and they're ready to give us as much as we want. To add nutrients and organic matter. And then we used biochar. We had another source for that of a high quality that could not only add absorption of metals, but organic matter and water holding characteristics. The last bullet is talking about locally effective microbes. One of the things that we believe is important to do is inoculate with local microbes or biology from the adjacent healthy soils. The idea here is to kickstart succession so that it goes relatively a lot quicker than nature would drive it, but that moves you on this trajectory, or Kate talked about your compass, because you're heading the right direction and you're moving. And we have been developing and working on a strategy for creating inocula from native healthy soil, making a tea that can be applied to the soils once we apply our amendments. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. One of the things, so at Formosa, we have come in and we've done some tests with lime to see how much we need to add. We've figured out what kind of nutrient levels we need to add when we use biosolids. But one of the things that is important to know is if we're going to use biochar, which is this charcoal-like material, they're not all created the same. They have different properties, and so we developed a strategy for screening these using the synthetic precipitation leaching protocol, in which we extract the existing soil or spoil soil at Formosa with the SPLP. We filter it, and then we expose the biochars to that. And I'll give you an example of how that works in a second. And then from this, we figure out what the best biochar is and use that as an amendment. And again, we screen for the amount of amendment to add. So if you look at this figure, and, well, you have to just believe me, all the notation is backwards, which is odd, but this is zinc concentration in the SPLP solution. The black bar on the left is at 8,400 parts per million zinc. So that's what's in the solution, bar here. And then we exposed it to 38 different biochars out of our library. And I'm sorry that it looks this way, but... this one here, which is ARS wood, so everything got moved down a little bit, is actually this one, removed 100% of the zinc. It also took out 100% of the cadmium, manganese, iron, and nickel. So it was really effective at removing metals. So what that tells you is that any metals that get in solution, you're going to have water to grow plants, and you're going to have some solubility metals, could be and would be absorbed by that biochar. So we selected that one. Okay. This next slide shows a way that we start testing the vegetation. We work with BLM botanists, we have EPA botanists, and we came up with a plant list of 5 to 8 plants that we want to sort of revegetate the site with. In this particular case, it's Elemis glaucus, which is a grass that's native to the area. And if you look at left to right, you'll see just the seeds on a bit of blotting paper, and these are all at the same stage when we planted and when they germinated. And I've got some close-ups here, but you'll see as you go along, it's the seeds and just the soil. Seeds plus the soil and some lime, and we've had some fertilizer. Then we had 1%, 2.5%, 5% biochar. And so if you look at this figure, you'll see that if you add nothing, you get nothing. If you add some lime, you do get some response. You know, we do get some germination. So adjusting the pH alone will help you. This next slide shows what the addition of biochar does, 1%, 2.5%, 5%. If you look at the color and the biomass, adding 5% biochar would be the best thing you could do, but that's a lot of biochar, and I'll show you what that looks like in a minute. But we eventually selected 2.5% biochar, and this is by weight. Then we conducted a series of greenhouse studies looking at this particular case is Douglas fir, and we had a local seed source, meaning the seeds came within a mile of the mine site. So we know these trees are adapted for these climatic conditions. We tried a series of different combinations of biosolids, biochar, and lime, and looked at those results. And once we had this information together, we were ready to go to the field. The first thing we did was come in and prepare for planting trees. And panel A, up in the upper left-hand corner up here, shows what the amendments are. This is the volume of 2.5% biochar, 1% lime, and 0.25% of biosolids. We were fortunate to have the geoprobe team from the ADA lab, EPA lab. They came and their geoprobe and drilled basically holes in this material, brought out the soil. So the ratio was 3 buckets of soil to these amendments, all put in the mixer down in panel C, mixed together, and these were put back in the hole. At this point, I would say, so these were done in August of 17, and so we let them sit and react till November of 17, which you got to have some time for these things to react. They aren't instantaneous. If we were to plant trees that same day, they all would have died, because it takes time in this dry condition. You need to have some water for the reactions to occur. And so after we had them, let them sit for a while, we came in, and this is kind of an aerial view of our site. You can see the holes that were drilled up across the slope. Just a couple of my crew doing some work there. And we've added the amendments to these sites, and then we came in November, and this spacing is what you, if you talk to Weyerhaeuser, this is the spacing they use in commercial forestry for planting trees. And we planted trees in November 17. And we did two kinds of inocula. One was we just used soil from the target site, and then we used LEM, which is, again, that extracted inocula, the inocula tea. And if you look at this next figure, it shows this is what the site looked like in November. We came in, we planted the seedling, and this is what they look like when they were planted. Yeah, in the fall of 2018, we came in the area between the rows and prepped for doing an herbaceous plant study, and I'll talk about that in a moment. So this is what the site looked like after we planted in November of 17. And this is showing us with the plots that we set out, lime, biochar, and we tilled this material in. Again, this is not a site remediation. This is a research study to test the efficacy of using soil amendments. So once we have the prescription right, we will remediate this whole area, and actually we're working on that now. And in April of this year, this is what we planted in herbaceous in 60 plots of this. So this is some results then. If you put no amendments in, which is part of the controlled study, in the herbaceous plot, this is what you get, virtually nothing. One of our treatments was all those amendments, but without biochar, but we replaced the nutrients that biochar supplies, and it's mainly potassium, you get this result. This is 5 months later. Turns out the deer really like some of our plants, so we've got to do some gauging for that. And then if you include biochar, it looks like this. And so one of the things that the last time we went out and made plant measurements, I had the crew measure the soil moisture. And one of the things that biochar does is help with the moisture regulation. The biochar plots had approximately 25% volumetric water content when the other plots were down around 5%. So we know that having biochar will help hold soil moisture over the dry period. Okay, I want to show this as these are these trees that were planted in 2017, almost 2 years later. But if you take a look at the image on the right, the red arrow shows the growth this year. So it grew from this node, it had one flush, a second flush, it grew 40 centimeters. In this area, that's evidence of a very happy tree. So we're certain we've got the remediation dialed in for the trees. We're fairly certain we have it dialed in for the herbaceous plants. So then let me kind of just step you through where we've come. So at the Formosa site then, we've gone through the first four steps of this framework. We're testing and we're concluding we think we have it dialed in. The next step then is coming down to the site remediation and then working with the RPM and the prime contractor, and we've already written the prescription for them. We've met with them, and it's now being developed into a contract to come in to amend and revegetate the site. And again, you know, this won't be done and, you know, one done walk away. We'll monitor, and there'll be some instances, I'm sure, we'll have failures, we'll have to do some adjustments. But this is the prescription, and this is the general plan for getting this done. So sort of in wrapping up, you know, I think that, again, and this is not new, but I'm just encouraging you to consider this and being strategic about using soil amendments, because I think it's got quite a future in the HIP2 site remediation, revegetation, revitalization. And I would say, you know, I was out looking at some sites this morning that once the removals are done, if you had a plan in place, you know, in large sites, if you could come in within weeks to months to having your amendments applied and plants planted, you could get down the road fairly quick, in at least as you start remediating and cleaning up sites to getting them revegetated. I believe, and I know there's some papers on this, that given other options, soil amendments can be a really cost-effective way of doing this, especially if you're using waste from another process, like excess biomass turned into biochar, can be a really great use of this material. Keep it out of the landfill and do some good with it. I would say, and Kate has mentioned this too, it takes good data, takes good planning, and you do have to be adaptive. You're going to learn some decisions in places you get, you're going to have to change your plan. But I think our framework, if followed, and we can encourage you and help you with that, would really help you come up with a prescription for mending your sites with soil amendments and leading to a cleanup. And I got to put a shameless plug in for biochar. I think it's got a lot of potential, and I'd be glad to help you with that too. So that's my last slide, and if you want to get a hold of me, here's my contact information, and I'll stop there.
All right, well, thank you, Mark. We did have a couple of questions that came in. We have a couple of minutes to answer them, so I'd like to pose a couple of questions to you. Related to biochar, sometimes this is a material that is produced from other materials. And one of our participants was wondering if there are any, is there a potential for additional materials in here, any organics that might be toxic or detrimental to the plants might leach out? Or is it tested?
Right. So, that you would have to determine it. But from the things that we've looked at, In all the domestic biochars, we don't see a lot of it. There are some plants, and a lot of times it's these tropical plants that accumulate some odd metals. I know there's some hyperaccumulators, you have to avoid those, but I think an important thing is probably to test it. But I would always test, measure, you know, don't make any assumptions. But in general, though, if it's made at high temperature, but you end up, and out of softwoods, that's what we've been finding, there's no issues.
Okay. So another question has to do with kind of your starting point of how do you determine the initial applications? I noticed you're in your tests, you started with zero and you went to 2.5 and then 5%. Is that something that you just learned essentially through previous experience? Why didn't you start at 10, 20, 30?
That's a really good question. And a lot of the way we came down on that was calculating the volume of material. What's practical? I think I said at one point, in fact, I had a colleague who had added up to 15% biochar by volume and was growing wheat using a Formosa soil, but that's not practical. If you think about what 2.5% looks like by weight, you multiply that by 7 or whatever it is to get up to, let's say, 2 or 3 times. You think about that volume mixed with 3 5-gallon buckets of soil, it's just too much. You're replacing the entire volume almost. So, and we also looked at cost. Early on, that was a big issue, and it's still an issue you got to think about. But it's dialing it in. And I think I used to, when I first started working with biochar, I had the notion that it would solve all of our problems. It does not. And working with other amendments included in it will really, in combination, I think, solve multiple problems at the same time. But to answer the question quickly, it became experience and looking at the literature.
Okay, and a really quick follow-up. Are these amendments just applied once to the soil, or is there a multiple application?
Okay, so that's a really good question. I would like to think we could do it one time and get it right. And that's where I think a lot of the upfront testing in advance will help you determine that. You know, we're monitoring. We now have trees in place at Formosa for 2 years. We're sampling next month to, 2 years after the planting and our initial soil sampling to see how much the soils have changed. We do believe in some cases, and we've been debating this, do we need to come in and apply more nutrients? The goal is to have a one-time. You may have to do a little maintenance if the pH starts dropping or if it runs out of nutrients. In our herbaceous plots, we mix in nitrogen fixers with it. And again, we've added biosolids, which is a really good source of phosphorus and other nutrients. So I think we'll probably be in pretty good shape in those. But strategic plants, strategic amendments.
All right. Thanks very much, Mark. We will have some additional time at the end of this session. So if you have additional questions, please pose them, and we'll try to get to them. So now I'd like to turn it over to our final speaker, Chris Eckley, who's going to talk about remediation of ecosystems that have been impacted by mercury at mine sites. Chris.
All right. Thanks, Jim. And also thanks to Gene for all your work organizing this session. It's been really good so far. I've enjoyed listening to Kate and Mark's presentations. So the talk that I'm going to be giving is on mercury downstream from abandoned mine sites. And so this presentation is an offshoot of a paper that I'm working on with the co-authors that are listed there as collaborators that will hopefully be coming out in the next few months in the Journal of Science Total Environment. But the objective of the paper was to do a synthesis of remediation and assessment activities that are happening at abandoned mine sites, specifically mercury sites. So to start out with a little bit of background on mercury pollution in general. So most of the mercury released into the environment is in an inorganic form, And that inorganic form can be in different species of mercury. You can have gaseous elemental mercury, HG0, particulate bound mercury, oxidized mercury, and the type of mercury that's released into the environment has a big impact on its fate and its transport. In particular, that form HG0 has a relatively long atmospheric lifetime of between half a year to 2 years, which allows for its widespread dispersion in the atmosphere before its eventual deposition. And that can add complexity to mercury-contaminated sites because you can have mercury transported globally before its eventual deposition. So most of the mercury released into the environment is in an inorganic form. However, almost all human exposure to mercury is to an organic form, methylmercury, abbreviated throughout this presentation as MEHG, shown down below there. And because there's that disconnect between the form of mercury that's released and the form of mercury that people are exposed to, it's important that we understand how mercury is transported, how it's methylated in the environment, and then eventually how it bioaccumulates into fish. And one, you know, probably the most important aspect of that is that methylation step. And I don't have any other slides on methylmercury production, but I'll briefly go over it here. In general, methylation is a microbial process. Specifically, anaerobic bacteria are involved with methylation. And so anything that affects that microbial community can affect how much methylmercury is produced. So the microbes need a source of organic carbon as well as a source of electrons, which they use. Sulfate or iron are common examples. And so the factors that can affect methylmercury production can have a big impact on how much methylmercury eventually ends up in the fish. And I'll get into that in some of the following slides and show the implications of that. Whoops, I think I just lost. Maybe
it'll be coming right back up.
Okay. Sorry, was that something I did on my end?
Don't worry. We can always fix it.
Sounds good. Okay, perfect. So within the mercury at mine sites, there are different types of mine sites that have elevated mercury concentrations. So the most obvious one would be mercury mines, abandoned mercury mines, where the mine was developed specifically because there's high concentrations of mercury there, and the desire is to create mercury as the product. However, there are also a lot of gold and silver mines where mercury was used as part of the amalgamation process, and that was mostly done during the 1800s. And in this figure you can see on the right, in the coastal range of California, you have in the red dots, you have where mercury mines were, and then all throughout the Sierra Nevadas was where all that gold rush was happening in the 1800s. And a lot of that mercury that was mined in the coastal range was eventually used during the gold rush in the gold mines. So a lot of those abandoned gold mines can have very elevated mercury concentrations. And interestingly enough, even though that practice is largely not utilized anymore within North America, still within South America, Asia, and parts of Africa, there is still widespread contemporary small-scale artisanal gold mining that uses mercury in that same sort of amalgamation process. And recent global estimates of emission sources of mercury put releases of mercury from those artisanal small-scale gold miners at the largest global source of mercury, which is pretty amazing to think about, because in that process of amalgamation with the gold, the way that they separate the mercury from the gold is by volatilization, because the mercury has a lot lower temperature of evaporation than gold, and so you basically take a blowtorch to that mercury-gold amalgam and put the mercury into the air to have the gold. So important global source. The last type of mercury contaminated mine site would be a mine that is located in a naturally geologically enriched area, but where mercury is not necessarily targeted as a desired element. And so the figure here on the left shows basically the global Mercury belt. And obviously it's a coarse scale, but you can imagine that mines that are occurring within those gray zones have potential to also be geologically enriched in mercury. And there's a lot of gold mines that fall into that category. So to get a sense of the scale of this problem, there are thousands of abandoned mercury mines. Most of them are located throughout the western U.S. and Canada. But then there's also tens of thousands of gold and silver mines where mercury is used. So the scale of the problem is quite large. We're not just talking about dozens of mines. There's tens of thousands of these contaminated sites throughout the West. And unfortunately, that figure looks a little wonky. But the gist of it is that fish mercury concentrations downstream of watersheds that have had this sort of mining activity can show a significantly higher mercury concentration of the fish. So we know that that abundance of different mining activities within these watersheds is having an impact on downstream fish methylmercury concentrations. So to kind of show this in a conceptual sort of way, you often have these source areas where you have an abandoned mercury mine. This example here in this photo is from the Cinnabar mine in Idaho, but it's emblematic of many different mercury mine sites that I've worked on. So you have a mercury mine site located in the headwaters area with very high concentrations of inorganic mercury, and then you often have some sort of off-site transport through a relatively small stream because these are located in mountainous headwater areas. These streams tend to be pretty high gradient, have low organic carbon, oxygen, the water is very well oxygenated, so you don't have much methylmercury and you don't have much fish populations inhabiting these streams. However, you move further downstream and that's where conditions become much more favorable to methylation and to more bioaccumulation, and that's also where you tend to get a lot more sport fishing occurring. In these further downstream areas, the example shown there is from the San Francisco Bay, and you have a lot more organic carbon. The waters are no longer as well oxygenated. You can get more wetlands developing, and those are the conditions that are more susceptible for methylmercury production. So when we think about these abandoned mercury mine sites, there can often be a large geographic disconnect between that source area of the mercury, where it was released, and then where the actual exposure is happening, which can oftentimes be much further downstream, and the exposure is to the methylated form of mercury. So because of that, it's really important to get a good handle on these off-site transport, the fluxes of mercury into the water systems. And a lot of studies have been done of this from mine sites, and they've shown that mercury mobilization during storm events is a lot higher than during base flow events. And particularly, a lot of these sites, the majority of the annual load mobilized can be in a few large events. So a lot of the releases of mercury from these sites can be very episodic and very much tied to the discharge at the site. So it's important when characterizing and assessing site conditions to make sure that measurements also include higher flow events as opposed to just base flow, because that's when most of the load happens. And also, most of that mobilization from these mine sites occurs with mercury bound to particles because it's largely due to erosion and sediment entrainment is what's occurring here. And I'll give just a brief example. Here we have total mercury. This is an example from Black Butte mine site in Oregon. Total mercury on this y-axis, discharge on this other y-axis. Discharge here is in blue. You can see lower base flow conditions, and the mercury concentrations in the diamonds being pretty low. The black diamonds are the dissolved phase concentrations. And as soon as you get this increase in discharge when it's raining, you get a big increase in the particulate bound mercury shown in those open diamond symbols. Another example of this would be from Cinnabar Mine, located in Idaho. And at that site, we had found that over 80% of the mercury in the creek downstream from the site was bound to particles. And then if we look at how that those loads of mercury are occurring throughout the different seasons, so we have here graphed the particulate-bound mercury load shown by each of the different seasons, 94% of the load from that mine site is happening during the spring. And if we drill down into that even deeper, it's really happening, the majority of it, within a few weeks during the spring, during peak discharge, during peak snowmelt. So this is what the site looks like during that time period. And you get this much larger discharge occurring then and a lot of surface erosion. And it's very important when thinking about how we're going to remediate these sites that any remediation plans take into consideration that large seasonality to the mercury fluxing off of the site. So because most of the mercury is bound to particles, there often is a very strong correlation between the mercury concentration and the total suspended solids concentration. And so this is just from a data mining exercise, looked at 13 different published studies where total suspended solids and mercury concentrations are shown, and we see significant relationships across all the studies. And what was surprising with this was even though some of these studies are located, you know, in very different parts of the world, we see very similar slopes across most of these regressions. But where the difference lies is in the intercepts with these. And if we plot the intercept versus the distance downstream, and I apologize for these units being they're natural log transformed units, so it's a little bit more difficult to interpret. But essentially, the concentration in mercury decreases with distance downstream from the site. But if we're thinking about water quality standards, and often 12 nanograms per liter is a very commonly applied water quality standard for total mercury concentrations within the U.S., you wouldn't hit that concentration until about 100 kilometers downstream of the site. So the scale of the downstream transport and where the risks might be from this mercury pollution can be quite large and quite disconnected from the actual source areas. In terms of methylmercury production, this is using data from those same studies that were shown from the other sites, and basically showing that some of the areas where you have the highest total mercury concentrations, you can have a fairly small percent of it actually being methylated, and that as you move with distance downstream from the contaminated sites, the percent methylmercury increases, which is kind of the basis for that conceptual model that I was showing in the earlier slide. So there's a lot of emphasis at these sites in terms of fluxes to water, but it's also important to remember that mercury is the only heavy metal that can exist in a pure gas phase, and so you can also get significant volatilization of mercury from sites as well. And so at an active mine site, you would have you know, a point source you know, from a processing facility of mercury emissions, but then if you have mercury-containing tailings and waste products, you can get volatilization of that mercury to the air as well. And the relative magnitude of that air flux compared to the water flux is largely dependent on the meteorological and hydrological conditions at a site. For example, if you're mostly in a desert area where there's not a lot of rainfall, the flux to the air is probably going to be a lot larger than the flux to the water. And conversely, if you're in a very you know, temperate West Coast rainforest, most of the flux is going to be into the water and less to the air. A few studies have scaled the emissions from these mine-impacted areas. One example here is from a gold mine area in Nevada. Another one is from a mercury mining district in Slovenia. And when you scale them up, because sometimes these contaminated sites can extend for many, many miles, the annual fluxes can be in the ballpark of 50 to 100 kilograms per year. And just to contextualize that, that's in the same sort of magnitude as a moderate-sized coal-fired, moderate to small-sized coal-fired power plant. So those non-point source emissions to the air are not an insignificant source of mercury. And the magnitude of the amount of mercury that gets emitted to the air is dependent on a lot of different environmental parameters, one of which is the speciation of the mercury in the soil and or tailings. So when we're looking at methylmercury in a downstream fish from a contaminated site, it can often be difficult to know how much of that methylmercury came from that original mercury source, which in some instances can be many, many kilometers upstream, maybe even 100 kilometers upstream. Because when you get so far downstream, you can get significant inputs from atmospheric deposition, and as well you can have often different mercury sources occurring within a watershed. And so it's been a problem that has plagued these mercury-contaminated sites for a long time to really understand how much of the mercury in the fish comes from a particular source versus comes from a different source or from atmospheric deposition. And so recently we've been able to use stable isotopes of mercury to help answer this question. So I'll give a brief background on just what are isotopes in general, and then get into a little bit about how these are used. So using hydrogen as the most basic example, hydrogen has one proton, but it can also exist with one or two additional neutrons. Neutrons have the same mass as a proton, but they don't have a charge. And so you can have an atomic weight for hydrogen being 1, 2, or 3. So you can have all the same element, but different masses. And using now mercury has 80 protons, and it can have anywhere between 116 and 124 neutrons. And so you have 7 stable isotopes of mercury, and they range in mass from 196 to 204 atomic mass units. And they tend to occur in the same kind of ratio and relative abundance. And so we can use that information to look at isotopic fractionation. And so different processes that happen to mercury in the environment can change the abundance of the individual isotopes. So this is a simplified example here of mercury ore, and I just show mercury 202 isotope and mercury 198 isotope, but of course there's 5 other stable isotopes, so this is just a simplified version. But if you have a particular composition of these two isotopes in an ore body, and then you do some ore processing, you put that mercury through a roaster, those tailings are going to have a different composition, and in particular, they're going to be enriched in the lighter isotopes, because you get this mass-dependent fractionation happening, where the lighter isotopes react faster, and then those become more enriched in the tailings or the byproducts. So we can use that fractionation as a signature to try and trace the mercury from that particular source in the environment. And that relies on a few things. One, you have to have a very unique mercury signature that you're looking at from a source. And also, there has to be fairly minimal post-source transformation in the environment. And this has been used in San Francisco Bay. It's been used downstream of gold mines or mercury mines in China. And we've used this in Black Butte Mine to try and tease apart how much mercury came from atmospheric deposition versus how much came from a mercury mine source. So it's a very powerful tool that we can use to answer some of those questions. So in terms of kind of switching from the site assessment to the remediation side of things, commonly applied remediation options, and there's a lot of different things that people have done at different sites to remediate them are, excavation and removal as well as erosion reduction. So I'll give a couple examples of those in the next few slides. So this is an example also from Black Butte Mine where there was a removal action. There was a creek called Furnace Creek, and the tailings from the mine were all placed right in that creek bed. and it was a major source to the downstream reservoir. So over the last year, there's been a big removal action there, where there's basically all of the materials were dug out from the creek bed, and a new material was placed in the site, and a new creek bed was created, and this was shown to be very effective at reducing mobilization of mercury downstream from the site. These two blue bars represent mercury concentrations before the removal action happened, and then after the removal, you can see a pretty significant decrease there. Important to point out that even in the pre-removal action, there's quite a bit of variability depending on the particular storm event that's being measured in terms of mercury concentration. And that point is highlighted even more on this next slide. This is an example from Gambanini Mine, and it wasn't actually a removal action, so it shouldn't say that up at the top. It was more of an action that focused on erosion control, and this is from Kirchner et al. 2011, this graph. And what they showed was that it's important to look at the discharge when you took your mercury measurement. So for example, all of these gray dots are from pre-action being taken, and the squares and the black dots are these are from after, and these ones are from before the action being taken. And you can see that there was a significant decrease, but because there was a difference in discharge between when these samples are taken and when these samples are taken, it's important to create these rating curves to really understand the magnitude of source reduction that has occurred at the site. So it's easy to understand that if you do a source reduction, you know, if you dig up the tailings or you do erosion control at a particular mine site, that in the stream right next to it, that you can identify a decrease in the total mercury concentration. That makes sense. But the question has been, is how effective are those source control actions at actually reducing methylmercury concentrations in downstream fish? And there's this great figure that was provided to me by Carrie Austin at the California Water Control Board, where they have quantified before and after mercury concentrations in fish in a bunch of different sites. Only one of these is from a mine site. A bunch of the other ones are from other types of mercury-contaminated sites. But the take-home message from this is that source controls of total mercury can be effective at reducing methylmercury concentrations in downstream fish. The one thing, though, that's important with this is this red line down here where it's the target fish mercury concentration. So this is an example from California where it's 0.2 milligrams per kilogram is the target value. Nationally, within the U.S., it's 0.3 milligrams per kilogram, so fairly similar. And you can see that even after source reductions and remediation has happened, the fish often remain above those targeted levels. And so there might, in order to meet targeted fish methylmercury concentrations, additional actions might need to be taken at these. And I'll get into those in a little bit further with these slides here. So back to this slide with all these different remediation options. These often are most effective when the sites are highly contaminated, cover a relatively small area, are easily accessible, and you have a really large remediation budget where you can go in and do these excavations or these large erosion control activities. But alternative options are needed when you have moderate levels of concentration. It's been widely dispersed throughout the environment, and you know, you're in a remote area, there's difficult access, and or there's limited funding. And so one example, and this ties into everything that Mark had presented in his talk, is using in-situ amendments to control erosion, because a lot of these mine sites are unvegetated. And so if you can add a soil amendment to stabilize by vegetating those areas, then that can be important in reducing the mercury transport downstream. Important caveat, though, with this, that we did an experiment from tailings from that cinnabar mine in Idaho where we added an organic soil amendment. It's not biochar. This is with a proganics amendment, which has not been pyrolyzed And so this carbon is a lot more available, and we compared it to unamended, and we wanted to see how that impacted mercury methylation and total mercury mobilization. And you can see the proganics is in the red and the unamended is in the gray. And so we got this increased pulse of that soil amendment resulting in more mercury being mobilized from those tailings, and then we saw a definite increase in methylmercury production as a result of those carbon amendments over time. And so when selecting a soil amendment at a mercury-contaminated site, we need to find amendments that promote vegetation and sequester mercury. We need to make sure that they don't have those unintended consequences of mobilizing dissolved phase mercury by having the organic carbon bind up mercury in the tailings and mobilize it, as well as having that additions of organic carbon stimulate the microbial population that then can methylate mercury. And currently working on, we just got funded a project with Mark Johnson to look at this specific question in a lot more detail, looking at biochars. And we're tentatively very optimistic that we can customize types of biochars that can help meet our objectives of vegetation growth and sequestering mercury. So there's also a couple strategies that you can use at a site to reduce methylation without actually reducing the total mercury concentration. Examples of these are redox poisoning. So because methylation is done by anaerobic bacteria, mostly sulfate-reducing bacteria, adding oxygen, adding nitrate, or adding manganese to a system can result in those sulfate-reducing bacteria being outcompeted and not able to methylate mercury. That's been these techniques have been used in Lake Onondaga at a Superfund site in New York, as well as in some reservoirs in California where they've oxygenated the hypolimnion to shut down the methylation. Also, you can change the amount of sulfate that's in the site. You can change the amount of carbon that's available to the microbial communities, and you can also do hydrological alterations that can impact zones of anoxic conditions and the redox conditions to try and not promote as much methylmercury production. Finally, there are also strategies available to reduce methylmercury in fish that don't require reductions in methylation or the total mercury concentration in sediment in water. And those have to do with food web and fish growth manipulations. Because methylmercury is so efficient at bioaccumulating in biota, anything that you can do to alter, you know, who's eating who, the length of the food web, what fish are eating, has the potential to decrease the methylmercury concentration in target species. So there's examples from reservoirs in Colorado where they've introduced lakes with low mercury content prey fish and have been able to significantly reduce methylmercury concentrations in sport fish, all the while not having to decrease the total mercury concentration in the system. And so, you know, those types of applications are possible in an already manipulated system or a closed system that's amenable to these sort of manipulations, but wouldn't be appropriate, you know, if there's any endangered species or potential for, you know, species to enter other areas. So to conclude, mercury mine site assessments and remediation can be optimized by using a lot of different techniques. We can use stable isotopes to understand mercury sources. We can target our assessments to understand how mercury is being mobilized downstream. And then there's a whole lot of methods and techniques that can be used to try and reduce mercury transport downstream, as well as methylmercury production. And some of these may or may not even require changing the total mercury concentration. However, in order to utilize these, a significant amount of research is needed to understand the specific mercury dynamics at that particular site. And while a lot of these more novel approaches have been used in laboratory and in test plot scales, in order for these more alternative techniques that target the methylation process to be more widely adopted, there needs to be more large-scale application examples out there. And during the question phase, if anybody that's, you know, tuned into this webinar has examples from their, you know, sites that they work on where some of these techniques can be used, I'd love to hear about them. So that's all I've got. I'll turn it back to Jim.
All right. Well, thank you, Chris. That was pretty interesting. We did get a couple of questions, and one of them, you mentioned how mercury can be sequestered in some of these amendments. And one of the questions came up about suppressing mercury volatilization, which seems to be a big issue at some of these mines. Do some of these soil amendments actually suppress mercury volatilization? Do you have any experience with that?
That's a really good question. I don't have any experience with that. But I do know that, I don't know specifically how it relates to biochar, but I do know that different types of amendments have been applied to tailings materials to reduce the volatilization from them. And so I think there are customizable surface applications that can be done to mine sites to reduce volatilization. And, you know, it's an interesting sort of topic because, you know, on one hand, volatilization reduces the mercury concentration at a particular mine site. On the other hand, it's, you know, adding to the mercury cycling in the global pool. And so on one hand, a reduction in volatilization from a particular mercury contaminated site is a way of, you know, keeping that mercury in place where it can potentially get methylated locally, versus if it volatilizes, you know, it becomes more of a global, it's another drop in the large global pool. So anyway, it's an interesting kind of question for site managers to kind of grapple with in terms of, you know, how much do they want to promote or depress that flux into the air. And I think that it is possible, but I'm not, from my direct experience, aware of specific studies using biochar to reduce mercury volatilization.
Okay, thanks. So your presentation focused on mercury and methylmercury and some of the solutions that we can apply, some of these more innovative solutions. What's your experience related to other COCs? Commonly what we see at these mining sites is, you know, a number of different metals that are impacting groundwater quality. Are there considerations for other COCs like arsenic or copper, which are also a problem to these ecosystems?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, so much of the risk, at least at the mercury mine sites that I've directly worked on, has been dominated by mercury, and so the remediation actions have been primarily targeted at reducing the mercury concentrations and loading. And the hope is that those would have beneficial effects for the co-occurring other metals at the site. But I am not aware of remediation strategies that have specifically been designed to deal with multiple contaminants. Fortunately, the behavior of mercury tends to be the most, I hate to use this because it's overly cheesy, but it tends to be more mercurial than a lot of the other elements. And so often, if you can control the mercury mobilization of a site, chances are you're going to also reduce the mobilization of other metals there as well.
All right, thanks. So we do have a couple of other questions that came up. One of them is related, I think this is probably best directed to Mark. So a couple of folks have noted that, you know, there's a lot of remote mining sites, and getting these materials and amendments up to these remote mining sites can be a real challenge. So two questions related to that. Number one is, how do you locate these relatively local sources? I think you said you had a nice source of organics 15 kilometers away. So that's one. And then related to the use of lime, Could you substitute, for example, concrete, which is pretty common waste material at some of these older mines, could you substitute concrete, which is locally available and more sustainable at these sites?
This is Mark. That's, again, another really good question, because I think it's important to look for substitutes. I know one of my colleagues is trying to get me to look more into using this FGD or this flue gas residuals that come out of, it's got lime and sulfur and these other things in it. I think it is good to look at alternatives. The nice thing about lime, I would just say, it's very compact and very concentrated. So that's one advantage versus using concrete. And I'm not exactly sure of the sort of the potential for adjusting the pH. You know, how much concrete would it take? And sometimes, like the individual said, you have monuments or things on site from mining operations that would be available and useful. You know, you have to crush it and get it to a particle size that's reactive. You know, sometimes that's the important thing, is having a really fine surface area. And then the question of remote access. I know Chris mentioned the Cinnabar mine in Idaho. It's barely approachable in the wintertime, or maybe not even approachable. Helicopter is a good way to get in there. But the site is relatively small. So, you know, we're trying to figure out a strategy. You know, we're going to first try to figure out what amendments would work there, and then it's the scaling up and figuring how to get them there. And I'll be honest with you, this is where some of the cost can begin to soar. Finding local sources for biochar is becoming easier. It's become a really boutique type industry. There's a lot of people who are trying to, you know, make a business or a living at doing this. The important thing is to get the, I believe, if I was to give you a rule of thumb, a high temperature gasified material. It's just cleaner and has a greater surface area for reactions to occur. However, say if you're doing like a chrome 6 remediation, you may want to use a low temperature biochar that has available carbon that could feed microbes, produce electrons for reduction from chrome 6 to chrome 3, and then a biochar that absorbs the chrome 3. So there's a lot of strategies to it, and every situation is going to have a slightly different adaptive management solution. How's that for using a term from Bruce?
That's great. That is awesome. All right. Well, folks, that brings us to the end of this presentation. I'd like to thank the speakers and remind folks, if you do have additional questions, please feel free to enter them, and we'll try to get back to you or post the answers at a later date. At this time, I'd like to turn it over back over to Jean Ballant. Jean, can you take us to the end here?
All right, will do. Thank you so very much. So I want to echo your gratitude and thanks for our presenters, organizers, and participants for taking time out of their busy days to join us for today's live broadcast. We have just a few quick reminders before we close out today's session. Remember, this is a multi-part webinar series that has been taking place this month on Kluin. So I hope that you'll be able to join us for the fourth and final session, which will be taking place next Wednesday, October 23rd from 1 to 3 p.m., where our topic will be big data, as we close out the ORD Office of Science Policy Mine and Mineral Processing Virtual Workshop webinar series. If you are looking for other webinars on mining sites, please know that we do lots of free training like this online, so I encourage you to visit us at kluin.org. We actually have two other mining-related webinars that are independent of this series. One will be taking place on October 25th, and another will be taking place on November 25th. So I do strongly encourage you to check out Kluin and look at our upcoming webinar calendar. You can also sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, and you'll get an email delivered to your inbox on the first of each month with information on our upcoming webinars. So I hope that you will connect with us and join us on future sessions. If you're looking for copies of the presentation materials, those are currently available on the seminar resources page. You can click to that on the middle of your screen under related URLs. I've also included a link in the Q&A window. There's contact information for our speakers and organizers there, and I will ask each of you to fill out our brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's live delivery. One of the most common questions I get are participation certificates, if we have those available, and we do indeed issue them, but only after you submit feedback for the event. And when you do so, please be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you are here for the whole thing or replay the entire recording. If you just fill out the form and you don't check that box, you will not get a certificate. So please be sure to fill the form out and check that box out. If you joined in a conference room with other colleagues, you can still click the link or follow the link to that form and fill it out to get your own certificate, even if you didn't individually register. And yes, for those of you who are listening to the recorded version, you can still get a certificate. Just follow the links to the feedback form that you'll see in the archive, and you can fill that form out and get a certificate based off of your replay. If you happen to be looking specifically for CLPs, remember you can request those, and we've included details here in the closing instructions where you'll find most of the details you need for the CLPs on the seminar homepage, including the title, the description, the date and length and number of points you can request. We strongly encourage you to include a copy of your participation certificate as well as either a printout of the homepage or the materials as part of your documentation. And so with that, our session was recorded. You will automatically get an email as soon as the archive is available. And we want to, again, thank you all so very much for joining us and hope that you'll be with us next week when we close out the series. So with that, we'll go.